Hello, everyone. Thank you for watching this special episode of Really Dicey. This is Manny, and I'm here with...
Hi, I'm Jeff Richard, the chair of Chaosium, Inc.
And today we're going to talk about Cults of RuneQuest, The Lunar Way.
Yes.
When I do these interviews, a lot of times I try to do very light preparation because I kind of want to be surprised and hear all the wonderful things a book may offer. But I did take the time to try to learn more about the Lunar Way. You know, usually when I think of deities that follow the moon in some way, in different religions, in different mythologies, usually they tend to be dark and evil and so forth. But when I looked into the reading about the Red Goddess, the Red Emperor, the Crimson Bat, and the nations supporting them, I can't say for sure good or bad. I think maybe it's just a different perspective. Maybe it's just a different form of culture and the way they view things, you know.
They're like the moon. They have a light side and they have a dark side, and they cycle from light to dark and then back to light again. For me, the Lunar Way is one of the remarkable strokes of genius of Greg Stafford. I think it's one of the most, all of the Glorantha mythologies I find fascinating, but the Lunar Way is particularly unique.
If I may ask, in what way, for those maybe hearing about this for the first time?
Okay, so most of the cults in RuneQuest are deities that embody elements or powers or forms or conditions in the world, and they established what they were before time in what's called the God's time, and they are what they have always been. So like Orlanth is the storm god, he is air. He continues to do all of the same things that he did in the god time, the age of mythology. And much of these deeds predate, they predate certainly any existing human culture, in some cases probably predate humanity itself. The existence of mortals. The Red Goddess, so that's the founder of the Lunar Way, well, she died in the God's time, was broken apart. And at the beginning of time, there was no red moon in the sky. She was just a broken thing. And the Lunar religion was founded when a group of individuals, called now in the Lunar religion, the Seven Mothers, they were basically pushed into an incredibly desperate situation where there was a big empire that was steamrolling through their lands and crushing them. And they had no allies. They had no support. And they were pressed against the wall, and so they did something desperate. They performed magical rituals and hero quests to go and find the broken parts of a dead goddess and bring her back to life, incarnate her as a mortal person so that she could do something new. And so she was a god, but she was also a mortal. And so she managed to combine or straddle opposites, and that goes throughout the mythology of the Red Goddess. And the other thing that the Red Goddess embodies is both life and fertility, so growth and new birth, but also chaos, doom, destruction, the void. And she straddles both of these. She is both a very benevolent deity who protects her people, who offers us cosmic and spiritual liberation. And she's also rides a chaos demon, drives people mad, can destroy your mind if you think about her too much, etc., if you're her foe. So she's this combination of a little bit of Hecate, a little bit of Artemis, and then something just completely unique, this goddess in time who defeated the enemies of the Seven Mothers and kept conquering and founded an empire, which she gave to her son to rule. And then she had her apotheosis, performed a great dance, and rose up into the sky as a red moon, which just looms directly above the capital of the Lunar Empire. And I just think that's just, you know, it's a combination of great, cool mythology and also just gonzo fantasy.
Mm. And under the Red Empress and the Red Goddess and the Red Emperor, they're also family of sorts, yeah. Family of gods, goddesses. Like there's, I'm still learning this as I'm reading about it because it's very, very expansive. There's the seven daughters from the Emperor, and then
Yep, the emperor himself is a complex figure. He is the son of the Red Goddess, and for a couple hundred years, he ruled as this immortal demigod, and then he got killed. And he tried to come back from the dead, managed to resurrect himself or return from the world of the dead, got killed again. And this time he couldn't come back in his old form. So there has to be a Red Emperor. So somebody else became the Red Emperor and proved that he was the Red Emperor. But prior to that, he had been a mortal and most definitely was not the literal son of the Red Goddess. So you have this thing going on, kind of like in real world Egyptian history, where the emperor, the king, the pharaoh became Horus and Osiris and was these gods. But of course, that's, you know, and claimed divine lineage. But of course, he was born as a mortal being. And you know, during at least one of the dynasties, you carried on the fiction that the pharaoh was always the pharaoh, regardless of who was the pharaoh. So which is why in the art, you know, the pharaoh was always depicted, regardless of what it was depicted identically. You don't differentiate between that. And so the Red Emperor is, there is this element of the Red Emperor is the son of a god, at least that's what his office is, and he has to be able to prove it to hold that office, but he's also a mortal man, and the sort of mortal man that gets the ambitions of becoming an emperor. And you have that constantly within the Lunar Empire, because you go through this, and is that you can't say, if you try to say, well, they're a good, this is clearly good and benevolent, they're the good guys, well, they do a lot of pretty horrible things. They're an empire. Hmm. And they're certainly not what their apologists often say they are. But on the other hand, they're also not bad guys. It's a good rule. They seek the cosmic and spiritual liberation of mortals, where we are able to get beyond the conflicts of the gods, where we mortals are able to help heal the world and be able to transcend ignorance and fear. Yeah, these are all good things. Hmm. But on the other hand, the flip side of that is sometimes transcending ignorance makes you phenomenally dangerous and makes you do things that maybe somebody that had a little bit more ignorance would be smart enough not to do. And so you have a wonderful ambivalence in the lunar way that I find, you know, as a GM or a player, I find wonderful, because they're, you know, if we're playing a bunch of the players are a bunch of Orlanthi from Dragon Pass, the Lunar Empire is obviously, it's the bad guys. You know, that's the empire that conquered them and occupied their lands and has basically been the source of all their calamities. But they themselves are not bad people any more than the Orlanthi are good or bad people. They're just people. Mm-hmm. And they have a wonderful religious complexity to them. Boy, that was a long explanation, wasn't it?
Well, a wonderful explanation. I appreciate that. Now I'm understanding a little bit more about how this part of the world in RuneQuest works exactly. Because as I mentioned before, sometimes we hear about like anything, any cults worshiping or dealing with the moon in any way, usually we think of it as a negative connotation. But it looks like when I'm reading about it more and more, looking back into it, it's just, yeah, definitely complex. They're not an evil empire. They're just an empire.
An empire.
Any more so like all the empires of history in the past, Roman, Babylonian, you know, that's just how they were.
Well, exactly. And it's really hard. I mean, it's very easy for us in our situation now to, you know, from where we stand in the world, to be able to say, well, you know, all empires are evil. But on the other hand, empires are something that I think they're certainly innate in human history. There is often an impetus towards trying to create some sort of broad order over a chaotic world to impose them. Now, I personally tend to sympathize with the people that are on the receiving end of that, but I can certainly understand the impetus for empire. And one of the things that I think is very fascinating and wonderful about Greg's writings is how ambivalent it is on that, you know, that there is both flaws and sympathy for every group in Glorantha. And you know, to me, that's important for me to have believability in a fantasy setting. You know, our own experiences are, there aren't a whole lot of good guys, and there aren't a whole lot of unalloyed bad guys. Most things are a little bit of both. And the lunar, what I love about the Lunar Way is it acknowledges that. The Red Goddess it accepts she is a deity of chaos. Is that? Deal with it. On the other hand, she is a deity of fertility, of cycles, of balance, and something necessary for the world to continue. And she goes through a cycle, and that cycle, you know, you look at the moon, and the moon moves from a full moon to a half moon to a dying moon, and, you know, the black moon, and then it works its way back up to again an empty half to a full moon again, and these cycles are innate in the human experience. They're innate in the world around us. And what I love is that they're that through the Red Goddess, they're also built into the mythology of RuneQuest. And they're also great. They're great adversaries. You know, their magic is weird. They drive that, you know, you have your players sitting around going, asking the GM, hey, it's an aside, Jeff, what phase is the moon today? Because when the moon is full, lunar magic is arguably overpowered. It's much more powerful than ordinary magic. And when it's dark, well, you know, that's when they're the lunar's magic is at their weakest. And so you have players sitting around trying to figure out, well, you know, let's do this. If we're gonna do this, it's gotta take place on the day of the black moon. And you have this, you know, they're a great way to where suddenly things within the setting start mattering tremendously to the players to be able to do the things that they want to do, to be able to deal with their adversaries. And, you know, as if Star Wars has taught us nothing, it certainly taught us that a big empire is a great adversary.
So this book, now I haven't seen what's inside at all yet. I haven't even seen the table of contents. Oh God,
Manny, it's beautiful.
All I've seen is the cover, which is gorgeous. Gorgeous cover.
Oh, yes.
So tell us what's inside the book exactly. Is it similar in I don't know if style is the right word, but the way organized, the way the chapters are organized in the previous books.
Yep. So all the Cults books follow basically the same format. It starts with kind of a short introduction, you know, what's in this book, what's this thing about, then kind of an overview of the pantheon, and then it goes into the specific cults. Now, the Lunar book goes, unlike the previous books, it goes into much greater detail about the Lunar Empire itself, because it's so important to understanding it. And it also includes a short chapter, which is about the moon itself. And, you know, what would happen if you traveled to the moon? And could we have adventures on the moon? And the answer is yes, you could have adventures on the moon, which, you know, what are the places of the moon? You know, when I look at the moon in the sky, what do I see? And could we go there? And so it has the moon as a location, in the setting, and then just dives into the cults. And I think it starts with the Seven Mothers, which is the most popular of all the lunar cults. It's got the Red Goddess. It's got also Nizalor, the god of illumination, who is a very conflicted chaos deity that offers it, it. He shows us the way by which the blinders can come off our eyes and we can see the big picture of the cosmos in all its complexity. But on the other hand, maybe it's not such a bad thing that we are blinkered to some extent as mortals. And which again is part of that Greg Stafford ambivalence, where everything in the world has its price. You know, it has its cost. And even good things can be bad, and even bad things can be good. And it's and I think there's no other book in the Cults book that has such that embraces so much those opposites as this one. So and you even get the weird magic. There's special magic if you're able to become an initiate of the Red Goddess. She has completely unique magic that allows you to warp spirit magic to do all sorts of crazy things that shouldn't work under the rules. But you belong to the Red God, the Cult of the Red Goddess, and so you're able to make things work differently. like the other books in the series, it's got most of the art was done by Loic Mouzy, Agatha Bité. Some of it was done by Katrin and Asi Hikala. So it's just a gorgeous book.
If we may go back for a second, something you said,
oh, of course,
about adventures on the moon. Now, that's very new to me, just because I, you know, when I think of RuneQuest at the moment, it's a very Bronze Age feel. So when I think of traveling to other planets, I think of very sci-fi.
But keep in mind the moon. So the moon came from the world. It was raised out of the ground by the Red Goddess. It's 40 miles, roughly 40 miles in, it's either 40 miles or 40 kilometers, I can't remember which, in diameter. It's there halfway between the top of the sky and the Earth. This is Glorantha. So of course, the moon is an object in the sky. Of course, it's theoretically possible to get there. There's a bridge that goes all the way from the moon to the top of the crater, which is where the moon came out of. Let's go wild with those Bronze Age sensibilities.
Oh, I see now. I see what you mean now. Okay,
this
yes.
This is one of the things. One of them is, this is a personal criticism I have of a lot of fantasy in the last 40 years, is it can't decide whether the setting is really our world. It's a heliocentric, it's part of a heliocentric system. There's a sun, the Earth, and the other planets rotate around it, etc. And everything else is the same as it is within our cosmos, except there's magic kind of thrown onto it. Maybe there's gods and whatnot. Again, kind of thrown onto it. Whereas Glorantha proceeds under the idea that the mythology is correct. There literally is a dome over the world, and that dome is the sky. That is a physical thing. If I look up at the sky, it looks like an upside down ball, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Right? That is truth. That is the literal truth in Glorantha. The world is flat and the sky is a bowl, an upside down bowl over that, and the moon is halfway between that flat Earth and the sky dome. So of course we could theoretically go there. We could fly, right? Some of us have powerful fly magic, right?
Yeah.
So we be able to fly there. Or maybe we take the bridge. There's a bridge that goes from the crater up to the moon. Maybe we could take that bridge.
Oh, okay. No, that's right? Great. I guess I never thought of RuneQuest as the lands of it being as mythical as the magic and the gods and the people there, which, now think about it, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, if we're okay with the idea that, you know, I forgot the name of that Greek hero who traveled to the underworld to find
Orpheus.
Yes.
I mean,
if someone can walk to hell just by going down some caves, you know, why not? You know?
And we can do that in RuneQuest. You can literally enter, there are places where you can literally enter the underworld. Heck, if we go far enough and we go to the western edge of the continent and take a boat, we theoretically could sail all the way to the edge of the world where there is the Gates of Dusk, where every evening the sun god enters the Gates of Dusk and goes down into the underworld. Well, why can't we follow him? You know, now we're playing RuneQuest characters, and you know, most players like, I think that might be a really dangerously stupid idea, but we could do it. You know, and the red moon is one of these things, and it's important to remember in Glorantha that 400 years ago, there wasn't a red moon. It rose into the sky 400 years ago. 400 years ago, everybody in the world was sitting there, you know, I don't know, having their coffee or drinking their whiskey or whatever, and going, that's strange. What's that red ball doing at the edge of the horizon going up? And you can sit there and watch as this red ball rose up halfway into the sky. Wow, isn't that amazing? And that's one of the things I love about the setting, is that has the feel of of mythology, not just, you know, and not just Greek or Vedic or, but, you know, you could imagine that in a Egyptian story. You could imagine that in Aztec or Mayan mythology. This is how people imagined the world. And in RuneQuest, how the world was imagined by our ancestors is how the world really is.
So let me ask you about a bit about the culture of this part of the world. So you know how like a lot of the ancient civilizations and empires have a style, could be architecture, armor, clothing, food, things of that nature. I'm just curious, what is that like? If I were to live in the middle of this empire, what would I notice different than other parts of RuneQuest?
Well, so the Lunar Empire for me, my touchstone for it is a little bit of the Persian Empire, a little bit of the Assyrians, a little bit of some of the Islamic caliphates or even the Ottomans, right? It's this big, it's got at its center, it's got, you know, a big river system at its center. It's not, you know, it's not got a sea connection. It's a land-based empire. It's got a number of big cities, and they're ancient big cities. The Lunar Empire is only the most recent of many ruling dynasties of whatever empire is formed there. So again, if you think, you know, if you think your Abbasids or your Sasanian empires in the Middle East, you know, they these are empires that ruled. They didn't found most of the cities in that area. There were empires before them, and whichever one we're picking is the most recent and greatest of all the empires that have been here. So you have a even though the empire is only 300 or 400 years old, it's in a very ancient land that has a tradition of civilization that goes back to the beginning of time. It's it's also one where, because it has a tradition of a centralized administrative state, you don't have the same. Society is not just a whole bunch of allied tribes and kinship groups. You have institutions and cities that are greater than any tribe or kinship group. And you also have, because you have a big empire, you have a lot of cities at the core of it. You have a much greater extremes of the very rich and the very poor. You have all the blessings and all of the evils of civilization and empire in one place. And when I think about them, you know, my mental image for it is, imagine putting one of those great Near Eastern empires, but instead of it being in, you know, in Iraq or Iran or whatnot, you plopped it down in Wisconsin, Missouri, and Minnesota. You know, big flat grasslands, cold winters, hot summers, and you know. You have these cities with big towers and cults that many of your Orlanthe player characters are going to find a little bit terrifying, because there's going to be open worship of things that the Orlanthe consider you shouldn't be worshiping, which, you know, is again it gives it a very a very exotic flavor to it from the point of view of most of your characters. And it makes it both something that's desirable and also something that is uncomfortable. which I also think is good for a fantasy setting, right? You want to have a sense, you want to have a set, you want to have the other, whatever the other empire is, you want it to be something that is interesting and has things that are very desirable in it. But on the other hand, you want it to have things that you find frightening or uncomfortable with, because that makes it a, in my opinion, it makes a much more interesting adversary alternate setting.
And if I may ask, do the Lunar Empire have any adversaries? If you had a bunch of characters playing in this setting, what do you think would be some of the challenges they would have? What would
Game Masters put together? So the Red Goddess, the Red Goddess herself, her biggest adversary is Orlanth. Orlanth refuses. She's managed to force most of the other cults to acknowledge and accept her existence in the Middle Air. The one big holdout is Orlanth and the Air Gods. And Orlanth and the Air Gods refuse to they refuse to submit to the existence of the Red Goddess. So Orlanth, Stormbull, Humacht, all of these cults are enemies of the Red Goddess and vice versa. Stormbull, who's one of everybody's favorite gods, right? The great berserk defender of life against chaos. Well, the Red Goddess is a chaos deity. There could be no peace with the Red Goddess from Stormbull's perspective. She is an anathema, a blasphemy. Orlanth is the king of the gods and the ruler of the air, and she is an intruder into his domain. And she's a chaos god. And she is her very existence is a violation of the cosmic compromise of which Orlanth is a great upholder. So you have the Red Goddess' very existence puts her in conflict with some of the most popular player character cults, which again is a good thing, because this is these conflicts are mythological. And so then the players have to figure out, the Red Goddess, there shouldn't be a red moon in the sky. This is a gigantic problem. But, Priscilius over there isn't such a bad guy. And, Priscilius was really useful fighting against those trolls with us. So, Priscilius, we really don't like your religion and whatnot, but we're happy to work with you so you have that, because it's mythological, you have a degree of player, the players have the freedom to make their own decisions about how they're going to deal with individual learners. And of course the Empire's great nightmare are the horse tribes that live in the steppes to the east of the Empire. And they are, whenever the horse tribes manage to unify, it's a very, very bad thing for whatever empire is in that land. And, 150 years before the game starts, the last time the all the horse tribes unified together, the Empire was nearly extinguished. And so the Empire has a, if I'm playing a lunar, those horse nomads, I'm a little bit scared of them and intimidated by them, just like, in our own history, groups like the Huns, the Seljuk, the Mongols, the Scythians were terrifying to the civilized empires. So they've got two big inherent enemies. One is you know, one is strategic, the other is mythological. But the Lunars like to think they don't have any other enemies, but many of the people that they rule might disagree with that. You know, this is the other thing that happens with empires, is that empires often don't recognize that the people that they have conquered, defeated, forced into submission may not be permanently acquiesced towards that situation. Which again, I think is very true with our own history.
Indeed, indeed. So I'm sure viewers who are players are probably asking the one question, player options. And I know we spoke a little bit about new magics and things like that. Is there anything that players can look forward to in this book?
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, it's fun playing a Lunar. First off, because you get to so if I initiate to the Seven Mothers, the Seven Mothers have seven different subcults that if I really want to, I can specialize in one and just go off in that direction. So that the Seven Mothers include a war god. It includes a god of penance. And it includes a goddess of harmony and fertility. It includes a knowing god. So in some ways, the Seven Mothers have parallels to most of the Seven Lightbringers. But they're parallels, but very different. Their magic all works on this lunar cycle. So during the course of a week, on one day, it is very powerful and far more powerful than any other equivalent spell. And on two days of the week, you are as weak as a baby. Your magic is basically not workable. It you can't even cast it, which is a cool thing because you have the play. You know, you've got to work this out as a player of how am I going to time this? And which I find really interesting. And it is, if I'm a Seven Mothers character initiate, I may want to also start down the path of illumination. And once I become illuminated, and most religions view illumination as a terribly dangerous and even evil thing, because when you are illuminated, you realize you realize fundamentally that existence and chaos are just sides of the same coin. There isn't the darkness needs to coexist with the light. Evil needs to coexist with good. They're all inherent parts of the cosmos. And the whole idea of completely ridding something, you know, your opposite from the cosmos is ridiculous. You're actually eliminating yourself. But the really dangerous thing is once you're illuminated, cult restrictions are no longer, they're mundanely enforceable. They're no longer magically enforceable. And another thing that comes out of illumination is a realization that, you know, why not use the powers of chaos? You know, it's your choice. I may decide that I don't want to do this because I don't think that it's useful, or I offering sacrifices to these to the lords of terror is a in my opinion an immoral thing. But the only restraint on that is my own moral decision. It's not some sort of mechanical restriction that normally, you know, if I initiate to the god Orlanth, I can't draw in chaos magic ever. That's there's a mechanical restriction. If I'm illuminated, all those mechanical restrictions are dropped, and it's only what me as a player and a player character decide is appropriate for my character. So you have this tremendous liberation from so much of the rules of the game. And of course, almost what almost always happens is, well, you know, why not get that chaos gift? Wouldn't that be cool? It's really useful. And then you start going on a downward path towards, well, you know, okay, it's chaotic magic. It's a chaos feature. It's not a good thing, but darn, it's useful. And it's something I love on Lunar player characters is so often they end up on this ethical downward spiral, which is tremendous fun for role playing.
Is there any like new items, equipment, anything like that also?
Not so much. I mean, technologically, the Lunar Empire is a Bronze Age culture like the Orlanthi. Their advantage over the Orlanthi is not technological. It's that their magic is unpredictable. Their magic is very devastating. They are able to do things that others cannot, because they're willing to embrace chaos when they deem it's necessary to embrace it. They are able, even though they themselves are a civilized empire and probably one of the nicer places to live, to be honest. They, on the other hand, they are, if they deem it necessary, they are perfectly willing to work with and use things that other cultures wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. And one analogy that you can make with the Lunar Empire is, to some extent, they're us, right? We are a powerful empire. We have liberated ourselves to, and I put that in quotation marks, because we can challenge certainly how much we've been successful at that, but we've liberated ourselves from the traditions and restrictions of the past. We view ourselves as a largely benevolent society, but on the other hand, we're the only ones that have ever used a nuclear weapon against our foe. And what is a closer embodiment to the powers of chaos than a nuclear weapon? And so there's a degree of, to me, there's a degree of fun with the Lunar Empire, because they can be something of a mirror to ourselves. And I don't, you know, and I mean this from a broadly international perspective, you know, almost every country, certainly every Western country has struggled with this. You know, we try to be reasonably well organized societies that are protective of our people, et cetera, but we wield terrible, terrifying instruments of destruction. Hmm. And to me, I find that just an interesting thing to have as an adversary, is something that you can see some of yourself in. And maybe that's just, maybe that's too much Jung over the years, right? You know, what is the shadow? The shadow, you know, what is our adversary in Jungian psychology? What's our biggest adversary? It's our own shadow. It's that embodiment of ourselves, of all the stuff we don't like to look at. And that's one of the things I like about one of the things neat about the Lunar Way is, they're perfectly willing to look at their own shadow.
You've left me a lot to think about this book.
Isn't that every one of our, it's one of the things. So this is one of the reasons I love coming back over and over again to RuneQuest and Glorantha is, and I think we said this the last time, you know, we can have our adventures where it's about, you know, going into some old ruins and trying to steal treasure. We can have those, and that's perfectly fine. And there's nothing wrong with that. But we can also use
the setting and role-playing games to really explore ideas and to explore ourselves. And that's something that I find endlessly, something I love about role-playing games as a medium, but it's something I particularly love about RuneQuest because it basically invites us to do that every time. And it's one of the things that I also think is wonderful about the Cults books is each one of those books has a very different set of archetypes and a very different set of themes that we're dealing with. But they're all complex.
You know, this might be going off topic a little bit, but have you ever come across a player who's told you something like, hey, because of this game, I've rediscovered or become more in touch with my spirituality? Has that ever happened before?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Actually, certainly with RuneQuest, I've had people that have come back and say, you know, this has got me interested in spirituality, in pursuing my own belief system, whatever that may be. And I know RuneQuest players that range from, you know, very devout atheists to Thelemists, to Mormons, to Muslims, to Orthodox Judaism, etc. I mean, I don't think it's biased towards any one religious or spiritual belief, but it is. I have heard from many people that it's been something that has encouraged them to explore their own spirituality, which I think is a wonderful thing in this world. You know, I like to think it doesn't have it doesn't push you in any one direction, but it gives you a set of tools and experiences where, if you're so inclined, you might want to, you know, you can pursue what you think about the interesting, unsolvable questions of human existence. Boy, that got deep.
Yeah, it did. It feels weird. It feels like, let's talk about the game again. Like, I feel weird going into that.
and for anybody watching this, RuneQuest doesn't, you know, it doesn't demand that you can have a game. It can also be a game about ducks with swords. It can be, but what's to me important about it is and makes it so unique as a fantasy setting is it, because of that strong mythological background to it, it becomes something where if the players and the GM so feel so inclined, they can go off to really to use role-playing games as a way to explore parts of the human existence and then go back to killing, killing monsters and stealing treasure. You know, that's all, and that's actually a part of mythology, you know, if we think about it, is you look at the adventures of Heracles or of Rostam or Cú Chulainn or, you know, any other mythological hero. And some of what they do is profound. Some of what they do is run around, kill things, maybe even, you know, and behave like player characters. And some of what they do is just simply ridiculous. You know, Heracles wearing a dress and getting married to an Amazon. That's in the nature of mythology, but it's also in the nature of any role-playing games session that I've ever been in is one part serious stuff, one part ridiculous stuff, and one part, what the fuck are we thinking? Right? Does that correspond with your experiences as a gamer?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good, I would say it's a good summary of my experiences.
And
You know, so with the cults books, what I think is really neat about them is that they give a whole bunch of resources to players and GMs to you know, again, going with the part of it is just, hey, this is cool stuff for my player, right? I want to know this because there's some cool spells. I can get some training in this. Hey, this is the cool, these are the great advantages that there is for me becoming an initiate of Huaren Dalthippa. Hey, that's awesome. It's also a bunch of really cool stories and myths that are filled with thought-provoking ideas that are just neat to explore and think about. And part of it is also, it's filled with interesting and amusing stories. And it's something I'm dreading the series being over. We've only got a few more books to do.
Yeah, so are we at the halfway point, maybe?
Let's see, no? Lightbringers, Earth, Lunar, Solar, Darkness, Spirit, Water, Chaos, and Sorcery, Invisible Gods. So we've got a total of 9 books, and the Lunars is the third one, but of course I've actually moved on. I'm mentally already on number 6. So for me, we're for you and the purchasing, you know, you for the RuneQuest fans out there, don't worry, we're right at the we're still at the beginning. For me as a writer and creative developer, I can sadly see the end of this cool, you know, cool project.
So wait, I noticed you didn't include the mythology book, and I hope I'm saying this right. Prosopopeia.
Yeah, they're part of the series. For me, the mythology book is a key part, but it's a very different, you know, it's not these groups of cult books. And I wrote the mythology book so long ago that I can barely remember. you know, this is one of the things. One of the things that is interesting about writing as for me, I find always interesting writing as a professionally is the writing part. Usually, on any book that I've worked on, has been done a year or more before that book comes out to this stage, you know, to the release stage of it. So a lot of this is actually talking about something I put together in the past. And, you know, if you're writing on a whole series of books, your mind and your focus often is on something that won't see the light of day for another year. You're like, it's already done. Well, no one's going to see this for, what do you say, Jeff? It's done. It's, you know, that book's not going to be, it's still got to go to layout. It's still got to go to all those, you know, external editing and be put together. Yeah, but I don't do that. So it's done as far as I'm concerned.
So in a way, it's always a welcome surprise when you see the book and kind of rediscover what you wrote in a way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was just talking with a friend of mine yesterday saying, you know, one of the things I find interesting is looking at stuff I wrote several years ago and going, I don't remember writing this, but it really is cool. Whoever actually, it couldn't have been me who wrote it. It's far cooler than my own writing.
I heard a story once. I don't know if it's true, but I keep hearing it whenever it comes up. Like when we talk about Roddenberry, Gene Roddenberry, that supposedly he'll write a script, but he'll put it away for a year so that when he looks at it again, it'll seem brand new and fresh. And I'm just wondering. Go ahead.
Whether or not that's apocryphal, that is my own personal experience. I mean, when I'm finished with a manuscript, I can't look at that manuscript for months. I can't look at it because I'm too close to it. I can neither see what's good in it and I can't see its flaws. All I can see is, God, I'm glad I'm done with it. Mm-hmm. But you know, you give me 6 months to a year later where I've forgotten actually part of what I've done.
And that's when I can look at it again and derive pleasure looking at it. Mm. And my mentor, Greg Stafford, used to say, I can't look at any book. I don't even like looking at the books that I published for years until I've forgotten that I wrote them. And now I can look at them fresh again. And I used to think that was such a strange thing. It's like actors that don't ever like watching their own, the movies they're in. And now I completely sympathize.
I know for myself, editing any video that I'm in is always the most difficult because I hear myself and I always get angry at my past self, you know, but that's just, you know, but then sometimes if I do watch something old, I either appreciate what I've worked on or I say, oh, I got to redo this again from scratch because this is, I've grown.
Or in my case, it's almost always a combination of the two.
Hmm.
You know, it's the God, you know, that's better than I remember it being. But on the other hand, oh, I can just see the flaws.
Mm.
And yeah, but that's, and for people watching, that's part of the creative process of making anything is that it is, and role-playing games are a remarkable creative outpouring. And it's actually one of the things that I'm endlessly amazed that in this strange hobby business that we're in, the incredible amount of creative outpouring that's in it blows me away. And I try to think, you know, what other industries has that? I mean, the music industry, it's similar to. I actually think that it's probably because of the lower economies, it's crazier creative than the book or movie industry, because the publishing thresholds are so low on this that you can have, you know, things like the Cult series being made or Spire you can have just all of these wonderful, remarkable settings and remarkable games. And so as gamers, we should appreciate how remarkable this what do you want to call it, Manny? Would we call this an art scene, a hobby scene, just a scene?
It's hard to say. It's because we're having fun with it as well, but it's art. This is definitely art. The RuneQuest books. I will be very surprised if this is not studied years from now, especially by theologians, religious teachers of sorts, just to kind of look at how religion affects our lives and how immersed in pop culture. But
I think it's a crying shame that after almost 50 years, RPGs are not something that there is a lot more academic interest in. But on the other hand, maybe that's a blessing. And
Well, this is my theory. I know we're going off topic, but so I noticed recently we're seeing books now about Gary Gygax and about TSR. And I think eventually, as time goes on, we're going to look at more books. I'll be honest, I would be surprised if I don't see a book about Greg Stafford in, I would say, 10 years time. Just because he was one of the heavyweights. He was there in the beginning, you know, so I would be surprised.
I always think of the big three were Gary, Dave, and Greg. And, you know, Gary and Dave established the form of role-playing games. But I think it was Greg who was the first one who showed what you could really do with them and how wide we could actually use this for. But, yeah, this is, you know, for those watching, yes, we've definitely wandered off from talking about it in the book. So I'll make my final sales bit. This is, to me, the Lunar Way is tied with the Lightbringer's myth as one of Greg's two most interesting myths that he created that you can get lost in as a reader, you can get lost in as a GM and as a player character. And you also want to buy it if you're running room, if you want to buy it anyways, just as a gamer, but especially if you're running a RuneQuest game, because the Lunar Empire is both a great, it is a great thing, a great setting in its own right, but it's also a great adversary. So it's, you're going to want to get it. And it's gorgeous. I actually think the, you know, it's got the red goddess herself is just, you know, it's great. You know, she's red and a goddess who rides on a giant chaos bat. You know, she's like a psychedelic album cover from the late 60s brought to life.
Yeah, I was thinking a bit of, like, I could see a bit of heavy metal magazine influence, you know, that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I wonder, and again, this is getting a little bit off topic here, is you know, Greg started putting together Glorantha in the 19, I mean, the foundations of it came when he was in Beloit College back in the mid 60s, but a lot of the, you know, the Lunar Empire, the Orlanthe, Dragon Pass, late 60s, early 70s, San Francisco Bay Area. And I always wonder, you know, whether there was some psychedelic album cover or poster up there with some red goddess riding on a bat that caught his imagination. Cause it really does feel like it should be some San Francisco band from 69, doesn't it?
Mm. Yeah, indeed. And edit it slightly and it could fit, be like one of those classic album covers that we see
back. Oh, yeah. Then. Yeah. I mean, and you know, I'm afraid I'm a half generation younger than all of that. I mean, I can remember the Bay Area and as a kid in the 70s, but there is, you know, it's one of the things that I find wonderful about Glorantha is it draws four sources of inspiration that definitely was, you know, that whole experimentation with new age and with psychedelia you know, all of that counterculture coming out of the Bay Area in the 60s and 70s clearly influenced Glorantha. And so if you know, if you imagine that all of the Tolkien based fantasy, you know, is really kind of coming out of World War One or interwar England and the conflict, you know, out of that kind of countryside versus development themes from the 1920s in the UK, which I think there's a, you know, a lot of that in classic generic, calling it generic fantasy is a disservice, but I'll use that as a term anyways, but that kind of, you know, pseudo medieval has a lot of those Tolkien themes. RuneQuest very much comes out of U.S. 1960s, 1970s themes, which again is part of the reason I think it feels very real, because these are themes that still echo into, you know, into the present day, and also has it being very unique because it's not century old rural England that is, you know, where this stuff comes out of, but it comes out of, you know, it comes out of the American counterculture scene of the 60s and 70s, which I think is
still very present in the modern way, modern day, in a way that, you know, maybe the Little Britain of Tolkien isn't so present anymore. And again, I don't mean that as a criticism of Tolkien as a writer or creator, but just merely that, you know, he was drawing on a very different set of wellspring of ideas and experience than what Glorantha came out of.
Yeah, that'd be a fun video to kind of compare the two works. Because what's interesting, well, going way off topic, but so have you noticed in Tolkien's work, there's no churches, and I interpret that as meaning that it's because there's no questioning the gods and the cosmology of that. You know, there's no elf going saying like, hey, I don't think I believe any of this, you know, or rejecting any of the beliefs or anything like that. And I think it's RuneQuest is almost the same way. Maybe there's a few, you know, that may say or think different things, but at least from what I've read so far, everyone believes that the gods exist because the gods are actually right there in front of you doing things and empowering you, you know? So,
but what that means that the gods exist, everybody has different takes and, you know, okay, the gods exist, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we view all of the gods as being equally beneficial or equally useful for us. Mm-hmm. And the gods are also in the setting, the gods are locked in a conflict with each other. So you got to pick a side.
Yeah.
There's a certain bit where I always find certainly Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, even though there are some remarkably spiritual themes in those books and some, you know, really deep issues about, you know, what it is to deal with despair, how to, you know, don't get me wrong, I adore Tolkien as a writer, but they are very devoid of there being any spiritual belief systems in those books. You know, that they're beyond Sauron the enemy, there really isn't much else. Yeah, you would think the at the very least, that some of those elves who can remember Valinor would be able to go, no, hey guys, really, honestly, you go over there, that's the happy hunting place. You know, there is a life after death, there is all of these things in it, but you know, nobody seems to be particularly worried or concerned about any of that in Tolkien. And I think you're right. I think it comes out of being in a time period where just nobody would question that.
Yeah. Cause you know, sorry.
No,
you're right. Cause something else would, I mean, I think it's still kind of fresh, even though it's been thousands of years, you still have characters that have been living that long too. So there's witnesses and things like that. And, Sauron and Morgoth, I think, who was before Sauron.
Morgoth.
Yes. Yeah. So they're still fresh in a way, in certain creatures, certain, elves, Maiar, memory, you know, so it's interesting, you know, maybe one day I'll look into it further, maybe do a video once I delve more into RuneQuest and, you know, kind of make it.
Yeah. I mean, video. RuneQuest, if we think of Tolkien as having written the great English epic, right? Early 20th century English epic, you know, very, very much framed by being in between World War I and World War II. You know, very much a product of that environment. Then RuneQuest is very much late 20th century US, with a lot of counterculture in it, and where
you know, what that is one of the great American or Western obsessions of the last 50 years is, what is meaning? You know, what is true? What is, you know, what does it mean to be a human being? And these are all questions that I think RuneQuest grapples with. And, you know, I'm sure this is an element of my own bias as being somebody who grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area of the 70s and 80s. But these are questions, I think, that are more up front and center to today than some of the themes that are in Tolkien's book. But again, that could also just be confirmation bias on my part.
So, Cult of RuneQuest, The Lunar Way, when will it be, when will it be released?
We're looking at end of March, beginning of April.
Okay.
We just went in, we approved the printer proof. You know, it's an absolutely gorgeous looking book here. We'll come out with a specific release date as we see the book showing up in the warehouse. Once again, we live in a world where international shipping is strange and unpredictable, which is part of the reason it's always tough to give out precise dates until you absolutely know. But definitely it will be for sale. I can say with 100% certainty it will be for sale before Chaosium Con.
And if I may ask, and you know, feel free to not answer this, but do you know after this book what might be coming up on the horizon?
So the next two books that will be coming out, we have a remastered version of the Glorantha source book with loads of new art and you know, brought up to the same visual standards. So the Glorantha source book, but the next big book is the Guide to Dragon Pass, which is the setting book for all of Dragon Pass. And that is just an artistically gorgeous book. And it's one of the ones where, as a setting book, I wanted it to have very much the feel for one of those. Have you ever seen those DK guides to London or Paris? You know, with those beautiful, beautifully done maps and really cool layout. It's very much the DK guide to Dragon Pass. Then after that is the Solar book, and then we got the Darkness and Chaos books coming out. And I think somewhere either in between those is the book about the Kingdom of Sartar. So is everything for playing a Sartarite, knowing about Sartar, all the tribes, all the cities, everything in this, the history, the culture, new cults, you know, new occupations, etc. So it's basically the Sartar player's book. So yeah, and then that gets you what, four books after this? So five books, actually. Solar, let's see, Solar, Dragon Pass, Darkness, Chaos, and Sartar. Five books, plus the remastered Glorantha source book. So I know all of those are coming out this year.
Well, that's awesome. Wow. Well, so, Jeff.
Yeah, it's a great time to be a RuneQuest fan, man.
Yeah, indeed. So many really good books. It's good for me because I'm now getting really into it. So this is, to me, a really good way to break in.
Well, one bit of guide is, back in the early 80s, Greg used to put all these coming next, you know, what comes up books for the RuneQuest line back in the early 80s, and a lot of them never got done. But if you look at those and look what we're publishing, we're fulfilling things that Greg promised 40 years ago. They just took a little time to get done. So well, sir, as always, this is a pleasure. I know we've wandered off into many side roads and detours.
Yeah, indeed. And I look forward to talking to you about the rest of the line. Wow, it's so many more books to talk about, definitely this year.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a good year to be a Chaosium fan. But then again, you know, every year's a good year.
Indeed. Well, viewers, thank you for checking us out, checking out this video, check our discussion, and stay tuned for more exciting videos. Take care, everyone.
Thank you very much.